The Utah Open Source Foundation presents the June 2008 meeting of the Ogden Area Linux User Group. Do you know someone in Utah who's always contributing to open source? The Utah Open Source Conference is looking for excellence in business, technology, and community for the second annual Utah Open Source Awards. To nominate someone, please send an email to awards@utos.org. Streaming and podcast hosting bandwidth for this and many other presentations at podcast.utos.org has been provided by Tier 4. This presentation was on Wine by Seth House.
So as you guys both know, Wine is not an emulator. That's what it stands for. It's just not an emulator. By the way, if I miss anything or if you have any questions, just interrupt me. How familiar are you guys with Wine, out of curiosity? Have you used it before?
I've used it. I haven't tweaked it a whole lot to learn specific applications.
What applications have you used it for?
Actually, I work over at FlyingJ, and the old ones over there like to program lots of internal applications for just Windows. It really ticks me off, but they run pretty good.
Nice.
Yeah.
Was it kind of a thing?
No, but it doesn't work well.
Really?
I can't play
some of the players. How do you upgrade
your version of Wine? Yeah.
As I recall, a very recent version of Wine broke Battle.net.
Yeah. I've got, that was a couple months ago.
Okay.
But I was a bunch of these over time first.
Let's see. Specifically, Wine is an open source implementation of the Windows API on top of X, OpenGL, and Unix. Is probably another thing. There's a quote from the Wine website that says, "Think of Wine as a compatibility layer for running Windows programs." You guys already know that a little bit. As you guys know, Wine is fast, much faster than any emulator could be. Windows applications that do not make system calls will run just as fast as on Windows. And it should be noted that speed is not now, never has been, a goal of the Wine project. It will eventually, once they get to a point, but they've already got the kind of speed that they do without paying attention to it so far. So what is Wine? What is Wine? Wine is two things, Wine and then Wine Lib. Wine, of course, runs the programs live. Wine Lib lets you compile Windows programs against the Wine libraries to produce native executable for Linux. For instance, Google did that with Picasa. Google hired Codeweavers to get Picasa running on Wine, and then they compiled it against Winelib, so that's why there's a native version of Picasa for Linux that does not require Wine to be installed.
Curiosity, if you compile something against Winelib, will that binary run natively in Windows?
I don't think so. I think you would compile it normally for Windows and then compile it against Winelib for Linux, but don't quote me because I don't know what I'm talking about there.
That's cool. Probably not.
So I was hoping to give a short rundown of Wine history, but it's been around for 15 years, so that's not a short version. I'll try and speed through it. Let's see. So 1992. Sun Microsystems had a program called, or bought a company that had a program called, probably on the slide, but it's not my note.
Wabi.
That's right. And Wabi allowed users of Solaris x86 and Solaris Spark to run Windows applications out of the box. Wabi was unique in that it allowed Windows windowing calls to be translated directly to X Windows calls. At the time, chances of Wabi being ported to Linux were slim to none. So in 1993, a mailing list was formed to discuss a similar project for Linux. Several of the early developers of Wine were some of the first Linux kernel hackers. You know, at that point, Linux was just 2-3 years old. Let's see. Within the first 6 months or so, they got Wine running in solitaire, and they've been cranking at it ever since. So, in 1994, things stepped up a little bit. Microsoft began releasing 32-bit code, so they moved on from Windows 3.1. They started adding new functionality on the operating system, so it was no longer enough for the Wine project just to load Microsoft binaries and run them. A more sophisticated integration was needed with the underlying operating systems, such as supported network connections, and registry files, that sort of thing. So, so in 1996, Word and Excel were reported to run, which was a big milestone. And in 1997, they created the winehq.com website. It was eventually taken over by Corel and then CodeCreatures after that.
Corel?
Yeah. And I'll get to Corel in just a bit. They played a big part in Wine's history. So in 1998, Corel jumps on the Linux bandwagon, big time. Corel's Office Suite, the WordPerfect, they wanted to get that running on Wine, and it demanded a high level of Wine sophistication. So they started pouring money into Wine. So this was the first time that Wine was being supported commercially. Corel was actually the people that contracted CodeWeavers to do work on Wine. And so that's where CodeWeavers comes from. Mm-hmm. In 2001...
Was CodeWeavers around before that
one? I don't know. They did not create CodeWeavers, they contracted CodeWeavers. So they must have been around in some capacity, but I don't know what they were doing before that. So in 2001, Corel made a deal with Microsoft. The particulars were, they spun off their Linux division, and they pretty much threw in the towel on Linux. So CodeWeavers began developing their own products and putting a lot of polish on Wine. They just kind of went off and did their own thing. Their own version of Wine included graphical management tools and an easy setup. The first product, Crossover Plugin, allowed Linux users to run Netscape plugins that were designed for Windows. Newer versions of that added more plugins. Then they released Crossover Office in March of 2002. To provide support for Office applications like Excel and Lotus Notes. That was their product. It was supported, so companies that were running called them up if they had problems. In addition to that, Trans Gaming was started by an ex-Corel employee named Gabriel State. He left and formed his own company, Trans Gaming, and their goal was... So limited DirectX support had been in Wine since 1997, but Gabriel sought to make it more robust So he released Wine X in 2001, and it initially had support for 6 games. Some of the early Trends Gaming work also sought to include support for copy protection measures. So that was the goal of Trends Gaming. Also in 2001, Lindos, the company, was formed. Lindos, as you guys probably remember, was formed to make a very simple Linux desktop that they could run Microsoft product or Microsoft programs just natively. But they quickly gave up that as a goal of the project. But before they gave that up, Lindos was responsible for sponsoring the very first WineConf, the Wine Conference, and that was in March 2002. And that was a worldwide conference. I don't know exactly how many wine cups there's been since, but there's been at least one fairly recently. And Lindos kicked that off. Let's see. There was another conference in 2004. An important point for understanding wine history is that licensing debates plagued the project for several years. In the beginning, it was under a BSD-style license. Around 1999, Richard Stallman pointed out that it was incompatible with the GPL, which potentially caused problems with any open-source projects wishing to use wine code. There was a big debate online, and the Wine Project ended up switching in 2000 to the X11 license. Let's see. And then shortly after that, in 2002, there was another poll conducted among the core wine developers and commercial entities that were invested in wine. About switching licenses again, and I guess at that time there was starting to be some growing concern in the community that wine would be taken by a company into a proprietary setup where they wouldn't contribute back. People were starting to get pretty worried about that, so they finally switched to the lesser GPL. The reason that was cool is that meant that changes to Wine meant that you had to re-release those changes to the community, but any programs that you would compile against Wine Lib did not. That kind of paved the way for companies that to compile say games and stuff against Wine Lib and run natively. Wine development picked up a bit of speed after that. This isn't quite wine history, but it's an interesting side note. I wasn't sure where else to put it. Microsoft has never really come out publicly and mentioned wine at all. That having been said, Microsoft Update software, as of 2005, somebody discovered that Windows Update was specifically checking for wine-only registry keys and denying access. So that was kind of a big event because it was Microsoft essentially breaking radio silence, also the Windows Genuine Advantage system checks for these keys. Other than that, it's been completely silent. So, some features. In June 17th, 2008, very recently, Wine 1.0 was released, 15 years into that one. I'm not sure about their naming scheme, but that's not a stable release. It's a development release. Yeah. It fixed a bunch of stuff. It went through the change log. In fact, I was messing around with one just the other day to get Photoshop CS3 to run. Mm-hmm. Photoshop CS2 was in the Wine 1.0. Stated goals of program compatibility. But CS3 was a little touchy for whatever reason. And it looks like 1.10 addressed some of those issues. I haven't tried it since I have printed them. I will.
Did you guys see it?
I downloaded it. I installed it.
Download the demo.
Yeah, the demo.
Yeah, 30 days to try it out.
So, some features. As you guys know, loads Windows 98 NT 2000 XP and Windows 3.1 and DOS programs and libraries. It has bug-for-bug compatibility with Windows. Now, a point of interest here is it will happily run Windows malware.
Yeah.
So keep an eye out for downloading strange binaries and running them in Wine, because Wine does in fact have access to Unix file systems. So just because you're running Wine doesn't mean the computer's safe. It has DirectX support, OpenGL support, sound card device interaction, networking, and it permits the mixing of ELF Linux binaries and PE Windows binaries. The whole list is at this those website here. It's quite a long list. So there's a lot of versions of Wine. There's Wine proper, and then there's the CodeWeaver suite. CodeWeaver employs the lead Wine developer. His name is Alexandre Dulia. And as far as I know, they employ one other guy as well that works heavily in the Wine project. CodeWeavers has a fantastic reputation of contributing back to the Wine project. As I mentioned before, they initially came out with a crossover plugin, the crossover office, and now their products are just crossover Linux, crossover Mac. And then they very recently released crossover games, and the only difference there is crossover games has a faster release cycle and less of an emphasis on stability. So, for example, crossover Linux and Mac have a list, a finite list of supported applications. And so whenever a new Wine version is released, before CodeWeaver releases a new version of crossover, they test all of those applications to make sure that nothing broke, because Wine will do that from time to time. If you've ever looked through, say, like the AppDB, user comments, a lot of people say, well, it works in this version of Wine, but not in this version. So you're going to have to downgrade in order to get it to work. That's a fairly common comment. CodeWeavers is very careful about their supported list of applications. Anyway, crossover games, fast release cycle. Although that having been said, there are two versions of crossover. There's standard and professional for both Linux and Mac. And the difference there is the professional version, it provides enhanced deployability, manageability features for corporate users. It also allows multiple users. The standard version of Wine only allows a single user. There's also Transgaming. Transgaming has two products, Sedega and Slider. Sedega was formerly called Wine X, and Sedega is a fork of the last version of the X11 licensed Wine. That was several years ago. At this point in time, there's not a whole lot of things in common between Wine proper and Sedega. On top of that, Transgaming has something of a bad reputation for not contributing back to the Wine project. One of the reasons the community is so bitter is they initially promised that they would contribute back their improvements to DirectX. Those improvements have never been seen. One notable thing about Sedega is they have licensed copy protection from the companies that create these copy protections. Sedega is proprietary, this change as well. Let's see if I can never make their way back to the line. It's all proprietary. In fact, this is kind of a funny quote from the Wine fact. Which shows a bit of anger. Transgaming, this is an actual fact that you can just read on the website. Transgaming currently gives back very little code to Wine. Sedega is not Wine with more gaming support. Because Wine has had years of development since Sedega was made, many games actually run better under Wine than under Sedega. currently Wine has advanced Direct3D, more advanced Direct3D support than Sudeikis, but Sudeikis still has more advanced copy protection support due to Transgaming's licensing of closed source code from a handful of copy protection companies. Unlike Crossover, most improvements to Wine don't get into Sudeikis due to license differences between Sudeikis and Wine. So, clear bias there toward code weavers. Quick rundown. There's also one other, which is ReactOS. ReactOS is a project to run. It's kind of like a free copy of Microsoft Windows, a free open source copy of Microsoft Windows. They have their own custom kernel, and they use an awful lot of Wine code. So they contribute. So Crossover Standard and Crossover Games are both $40. Crossover Professional is $70. And for Sudeikis, you can get a 6-month subscription. Sudeikis goes on subscription. Crossover has a subscription support model as well. But Sudeikis, you can get a 6-month subscription for $25 and a 12-month subscription for $45. So let's move on to how to get started. As you guys know, you just type in Wine and then the name of the executable, and Wine will start it up. In addition to that, you can type in Wine, and then in quotes, you can give it the Windows path, /, whatever, to get it to run. So here's a quick note about Wine prefix. Crossover almost enforces this kind of convention. In Crossover, they call it bottles. And what this is it you would install a specific program to a certain Wine prefix, or a specific set of programs to a certain Wine prefix. What that does is that makes those programs or program fairly self-contained, so that they if anything goes wrong with them, they don't take down the rest of all of your Wine installed programs. So for example, you would create a specific directory, in your home folder you create a games directory and put, Warcraft 3. You'd make a Warcraft 3 directory in there. In previous versions to Wine 1.0, you had to run a command called wine prefix create, which created just some basic files in that directory, such as the drive C directory with the Windows layout programs files directories and the Windows directories, and then some registration files, some of those registry files. Post Wine 1.0 will be created automatically if it doesn't already exist. So if you export the environment variable wine prefix and then give it the path to that directory, then it will install it there. If you don't do that, then it installs it to your home directory, .wine. This is a good habit to get into, because eventually something you install is going to take down the rest of whatever's in that particular wine prefix or bottle, as they call it in Sudeikis, or in Crossover, sorry. Quick note about configuration. This was the demo part of the presentation. But if you type in wine config, and you can prefix that with wine prefix again to pull up just the wine config for that that prefix, a little window will pop up, and in this window it lets you configure quite a few things. One of which is the Windows version that Wine is pretending to be, so Windows 2000, Windows 98, Windows XP. And different programs work better or faster under different Wine versions. So it's definitely worth playing around with, especially if you're having problems. Other things that this window lets you configure is it lets you... Wine has the ability... So Wine has native... Wine has native versions of Microsoft DLLs. Let's see... Let me double check that I'm getting that. Terminology right. Wine has its own his own versions of a lot of Microsoft DLLs. Of course, that's the point of the Wine project, to recreate those. But it can use the DLLs from an actual Windows, if you ever have a problem.
Yeah, I was trying to get Portal running, runs on the Steam engine, and got it running, but to get DirectX the way I needed it, I had to copy some DLLs straight out of a Windows installation into Wine, and it works great.
Nice. So I'm sorry, I got the terminology wrong. The Wine has built-in DLLs, and then it can use Windows native DLLs. Sorry, I got that backward. Let's see. So in order to use Windows native DLLs, you just copy them into the Windows System 32 directory, and then in this Wine config window, you put that DLL in the list, and you say, use the native version before the built-in version, and only use the native version, or only use the built-in version. Other things that are in this window, you can kind of see it here on my tiny screen. You can put in an application, and you can specify that application runs in a specific Windows version with specific DLLs. So you can set up a specific application in a Wine prefix to run differently than the rest of the applications. That's another thing about Wine prefix that I didn't mention, is that you can set it up to be very particular, whereas you might not want another set of programs to be that particular. And then in the graphics tab, and this is kind of an important spot to come for troubleshooting problems, you can set how Wine runs the programs. You can set it so that runs them. Lets the Linux window manager manage the window. You can create like a little Windows desktop with a certain size, and that contains all of your Wine windows. Sometimes when you're troubleshooting Wine problems, it's useful to come in here and change that. Let's see. So as you're starting up Wine, if Wine ever complains about missing DLLs, you should check whether that DLL is publicly available. And I'll get to that toward the end. Just do a search on the internet for it. There's a lot of those DLLs. You can download for free, from different places, free and legally, I should say. Let's see. Quick side note: it's easy to install TrueType fonts from your Linux system to the Windows to the Wine configuration just by copying those fonts into the C Windows fonts directory. That'll just work. So the other command here is just Windows regedit. So put that in regedit, go bring up Windows regedit, and it works just as it does under Windows. That having been said, I'm not sure that's. Let's try this. Sometimes we have. Yeah, sometimes you just gotta refresh S5. In Wine prefix, or if you don't specify one in the phone.wine directory, there's a couple of files. System.reg, user.reg, and user.def.reg. Now these are just text files that represent the Windows registry. So when you fire up regedit, it's actually reading these files. If you're familiar with the Windows registry, system.reg contains the H key local machine section. User.reg contains the H key current user section. That comes up from time to time. For example, with Warcraft 3, in order to get that running, you had to make a registry entry to have Warcraft 3 run with OpenGL rendering inside DirectX. Otherwise, the performance was just cut off. Regedit. So in order to run Wine, quick side note, Wine will pass on your shell environment in programs you run in Wine. So if you're running a Windows program that requires, you know, certain environment variables to exist, if you set those up in your Linux environment before invoking Wine, they'll show up. The exception to that is the path, system, and temp variables. Those obviously are a little bit more important and have to be set in specific ways. So I'm going to run over commands and configuration zones that are useful when running Wine. First is uninstall it. This is you don't have to prefix this with the Wine command. It's just its own command, uninstaller, and it'll bring up a graphical uninstaller interface. So you know any programs that have installed into that Wine prefix with, not just a regular Linux installer, that you know show up in the start menu and stuff, will show up in this uninstaller program, so you can uninstall them graphically. This is a big one. If you type in the Wine command space eject, it will eject the CD without unmounting. You don't have to worry about unmounting it from Linux. So, for example, if you're installing a program that has multiple CDs, you just type in Wine eject, it'll eject the CD, you can put the new one in, and Wine will just pick up where it left off. So you don't have to worry about unmounting things, because that can be a little tricky. Side note, that also works with ISOs. It'll unmount the ISO. Wine boot. This command simulates a Windows reboot. There's a manual way to do it, which is just removing a file in your Wine directory called wineinit.inf, I believe. I think that might show up in the Windows reboot. Anyway, but this will simulate a Windows reboot, which is occasionally useful. Let's see, Wine control. If any programs that you install have their own control panel configurations, then they will show up here. So that's a way to get to the Windows control panel. But the default Windows control panel does not show up, just in addition. Wine console is a variant of Wine that will run command line Windows programs. If you're just running a command line program that dumps text to the screen, then the base Wine executable is fine. But if you're running something a little bit more interactive, like a Windows command line program that's been written for curses, you probably want to use Wine console instead. Let's see. Wine file. I'm sorry, I didn't make a note about this one. I don't remember what it is. Anyway, and then there's Wine debug as an environment variable. So if you like prefixing the Wine command with the Wine prefix, if you prefix it with Wine debug, you can specify. You guys have probably run Wine from the command line before, and by default, there's just a literal ton of stuff that flies past the command line. So if, for example, if you export wine debug equals minus all, it won't do anything. It'll just do, you know, a couple of important messages. You can also pipe those messages to devnull, but this is kind of a built-in way to do it. And you can specify other things besides minus all. You know, so say like you're just interested in a specific error message, you can configure them here. I'll come back to that. And also, if you're running OSS, you can export audio dev. If you're running OSS and you have multiple audio hardware, you can export that to specify that Wine should use a particular one. So, getting into trouble. You guys have probably run Wine before and you know, had a hang, use 100% of the CPU and not really die. There's two good methods of getting out of that. The first is typing in wineserver-k. So Wine server is kind of the back end. So Wine works over the regular X11 client server model. So Wine server runs in the background there. If you pass -k to Wine server, it should just kill everything. If it doesn't, then you're left with kill all -9. And this is kind of tricky, kind of a pain, because some programs, like, for example, Internet Explorer, start up multiple EXEs. So, you know, you're going to have to kill them all. Off the top of my head, I'm pretty sure that Internet Explorer starts up IE something.exe as well as Explorer.exe, and you have to kill both of those. Then you got to kill the wine processes on the wine server. That's kind of a pain. But try wine server -k first. So, solving problems. If you're running wine, especially with games, you're going to come up with incompatibilities and that sort of thing. Your first line of defense should be checking the FTP. It's got ratings for most Windows programs, you know, let's say how well they work in, you know, certain versions of Wine, and there's user comments about, you know, instructions, this worked for me, that sort of thing. So that's an excellent first place to start. Like I said before, in the Wine config window, use different Windows versions. Also, interestingly, it makes a difference if you use different startup paths. So typing, you know, so in Linux, cding to, you know, your Wine prefix, slash drive c, slash program file, slash wherever, and, you know, typing in Wine, and then the executable name straight out of there, is different than running, that's supposed to be on two different lines, but that's different than running Wine, you know, and then in quotes, the Windows path, for whatever reason. Use different GUI modes, like we talked about before in Wine config, the integrated desktop or the window. And also, fiddle with DLL configurations. This is a little bit more specific to if you really know the program you're trying to run, not just some random, you know, Windows program, but like if you work at a company that makes a program, for example, this might be a little bit more important. So, for example, you can set Wine debug to plus load DLL. That'll just output error messages that have to do with loading DLLs. So you can see, you know, what's being loaded, what's being run natively, what's being run built in, and make changes as needed.
Are all of the possible Wine debug options found on the man page or something?
It's not the man page. It's not hard to find. I would suggest just doing a search on the Wine site or the Wine wiki, but it is easy to find. There's a ton of them, an absolute ton. And then dllfiles.com is that site that has free and legal DLLs. If you search, so if you can't solve the problem on your own and you need to search for a solution, really best first place to start, Google. There's a lot of excellent Wine resources, but there's also quite a few of them, so Google is a good kind of unifying place. The Wine FAQ, if you haven't read it, it's not a bad read. It doesn't take very long, and it's got a lot of tips and tricks in there. The Wine Wiki has a search, not a bad place to start. And there's a website called Frank's Corner, which is a little bit more specific, but it's a good resource. The guy does a really good job. For example, he's got some pages on how to get more criteria for money. So, lastly, we're nearly done here. What are we doing on time? 12:20. So, some helper tools. I'm sorry to say I'm not as prepared for this as I'd like to be, because I haven't tested two of these. The first is WineDoors. WineDoors is an application management tool for the GNOME desktop. I'm a little fuzzy on what it does. I think it's some kind of apt-get repository for Wine apps. It kind of integrates into the GNOME desktop. Excuse me. This next one is real important. If you don't use it with a new Wine install, probably making a mistake, because it comes up a lot. It's called WineTrix. It's just a little shell script that you can download, and it installs some very basic components, typically Microsoft DLLs, fonts, that sort of thing.
I think I had to use that one to get some like XML version 6 support.
Totally.
Streamline.
Yeah.
I think we were trying to get .NET, the Windows version of .NET, to work under Wine.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds about right. So if you just type it by itself, it'll bring up a little X message dialog. I can't even show it to you on my little EPC because it doesn't wrap, so just scroll up the two sides of the screen. It's really long. There's quite a few programs in here. If you do dash dash help from the command line, it'll output all of them. A quick example, the core fonts, the Microsoft core fonts, DCOM, DVX video codec, DirectX 9, Adobe Flash. Anyway, it's quite a big list. So you'll probably almost always want to install some stuff from there into a new Wine prefix. I don't have a bullet point for it. Yes. IE's for Linux. Now, this script is awesome. It's written by Ian Brazil. It's a little script to help you install IE on Linux. And it can install multiple versions of IE. Linux 4, 5, 5, 6, and it has beta support for 7.
Really?
Yeah. It's a little funky. A few times I've tried it, it didn't work very well. Because up until fairly recently, IE 7 required the Windows Genuine Advantage. But now it no longer does, so it's easier to run under Wine. But the IE's for Linux guy still had to shoehorn the Windows 7 rendering engine into an IE6 kind of interface. I don't know the specifics, so it's a little funky, but when it works, it's nice to have. A quick side note is IE for Linux installs into a specific Wine prefix in your home directory. IE for Linux. So it's using the prefix as well. Now, this is the one I really regret not testing before giving this presentation. But I didn't find out about it until just recently. It's called Play on Linux.
I've heard of it.
So Play on Linux is an application to ease the installation of Windows games using Wine. It uses an online database of scripts to apply different settings for specific games. For games that need specific configurations, like work back through game example, I assume. If the game is not in the Play on Linux database, then you can do a manual installation. So this is kind of.
You don't much chance to know if that uses by default prefixes as well.
It does.
That's cool.
So this is kind of similar to how Sedega and Crossover work. They've got a list of supported applications. So, for example, when you're running Crossover, if you want to install Microsoft Excel, you don't just fire up the setup file. You can do that, but the best way to do it is to when you go to the install software window, which I can show you actually. Let's see, what did they call that? Crossover install wizard.
Crossover standard, is that free to use?
No,
they're all for pay.
And on that note, you might wonder why you would pay for Crossover instead of just running something like Wine. And the answer to that is you can run pretty much anything, if not everything, under vanilla Wine that you can run over Crossover. It's just a matter of tweaks that you have to do. So, for example, here's the list of supported software in Crossover. So, if you need to install any of these, instead of just firing up the setup out of the CD-ROM, you start them up out of this list, and it'll fire up the setup, applying specific settings. And presumably that's what FlameOS does as well. It knows that specific settings are needed for specific programs. So for at the moment, Crossover Games has a very small, I don't remember how many, anyway, let's call it a dozen supported games. And that's the difference between Crossover Games and Sega at the moment. Sega has a huge list of supported games, whereas Crossover Games is just getting started, so the list is pretty small. That having been said, sounds like Transmedia is a little bit sad. I totally skipped over Saga when I was talking about Transgaming. Transgaming created Cider, although they're merging Cider back into Sega proper. But Cider was kind of a big deal when Apple switched over to x86 processors, because that enabled Wine to work on Mac OS. And Transgaming and Codeweavers as well jumped on that in a big way, as they should have. So, for example, if you go to the Apple website, apple.com/games, they changed this fairly recently, but if you go there now, a lot of those games will see a little graphic next to the game that says Intel only. And it's not a given that that's because that game was compiled against Cider to run on Mac OS, but a lot of them were. When that first became a big deal for running games on Apple hardware, Apple Games actually had a special little icon specifically for Cider, so that you could kind of pull it up to the list and see, just see off the top, just know immediately that this was compiled with Cider and it's x86 only. Sorry, forgot to mention that. So same kind of deal with Transgaming's CDIG. If you go to install the game, it'll come up with this little graphical install. You'll select the application out of the list, and it'll do all of that configuration necessary to get it up and running. And depending on what you're running and where, it might be worth $40 or $50. I guess 50 to 70 of the two different versions. Mm-hmm. Because, as I mentioned before, they pay attention to backward compatibility breaks, whereas the Wine project is not. That's that. Any questions? No. I saw that on the list of additional tools that utilize Wine, but I didn't have a chance to read about it. Do you know anything about it? What is the premise? I don't even know that.
Wikipedia here just says that can help from Windows software and Linux with the Wine compatibility layer, because then it removes the installation step of the software.
Yeah. I gotcha.
It's like they package it up somehow.
That reminds me of something else. You guys are familiar with Parallels virtual machine. The Parallels virtual machine utilizes some Wine DirectX code.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they've contributed back to the project. So I don't know specifically how that runs, but I guess it's some kind of performance enhancement. A lot of stuff I read about Wine indicated that whenever virtual machines become able to run hardware accelerated graphics, the need for Wine will evaporate. But I guess we'll see. Anyway.
Cool. Thanks. That was good.
Cool.
I'm going to have my ride coming up in 2 minutes. I want to give this book back to Seth. I borrowed the book. I had to tell you about stuff that I learned out of it. And I really actually just focused on the last chapter that talked about, or one of the last chapters that talked about, kiosks and how you configure kiosks and everything. And it was really interesting the ways that you can customize X for, you know, a publicly used computer. I'm working with Flying J, and we have lots of kiosks, and we've often tossed around the idea of using Linux. My wife works for the Elements Church, and they are kind of talking about having a public kiosk in some of the distribution centers. So I was, the kiosk chapter is very interesting. And the approach that I kind of took on it is, what would I do if I went into a public area, was using a kiosk, and realized, wait, I think this is running Linux, and got that little, you know, devilish grin on my face. What would I do to try to quickly compromise the system? But I think the first thing I'd do if I had a control and alt button is I'd try to change the virtual terminal. Well, there's a setting in XOR to turn off that capability so you can't switch virtual terminal. So the next thing I think that I would probably try to do is zap it and see if I get a login screen or something where you can turn off the control alt backspace zapping. I don't know, what would you guys do from that point if you wanted to get into a machine? I think that I would try to maybe on lots of distributions that Alt F2 will bring up a run dialog, or an Alt F4 will kill the running application. You can in the XOR conf you can map mouse buttons and keyboard buttons to other commands. So you can say, you know, mouse button 2 actually rendered as mouse button 1. So you can take off right clicks really easily. You can remap the alt button maybe to be control, the control button, or just the escape button or something like that, so it can't get to an alt F2, alt F4. So lots of little things like that. Put them all together, you could probably have a pretty secure, as far as being able to quickly, you know, quickly kill the application that's running on a kiosk or something like that. So it was interesting, very informative. We got one machine, which was really cool. Over at Flying J, we got one machine with onboard video and then two dual-headed video cards. And a bunch of USB keyboards and mice to run 5 separate kiosk stations, and it was really cool. Each one was just like its own desktop.
Nice.
All independent of each other. It was really neat.
Is that hard to set up?
You know, I helped with it a little bit. Sam works with me over there, and he got it going. He spent most of the time on it. It was a hairy, scary XOR.com, I'll tell you that. The problem that we ran into was USB devices and Linux, mouse and keyboard, don't always come up in the same order. So, you know, you'll say keyboard 2 and mouse 2, and we'll associate you with screen 2 and layout 2, you know, on XOR.com. Well, on the next reboot, this mouse might end up being the third one that comes up in the keyboard, the first one, and then the other one.
That's really annoying. Is there any good way around that?
I haven't investigated it too much.
Oh. I was thinking of doing something similar for my wife and I. Just setting her up a monitor and keyboard next to mine.
The 2 would be a lot easier than 5. I guarantee that.
That's probably a good point.
It was insane. And it was on like a small little mini ITX. And it was always even more bad. And, you know, one of the users shuts down loading and it just cranks the CPU. And so there was lots of problems, but it was really fun.
I bet.
Yeah.
Are there any...
Thanks for the book report. I didn't read that chapter at all when I went through it because...
kiosk.
Yeah. default configurations you can download to set something up in kiosk mode, or do you pretty much just have to kind of skim through the chapter and do what's best for
I haven't come across anything that will quickly set up like X for kiosk mode. There's lots of Like there's stuff for specific applications. Like there's a, I think there's a kiosk plugin for Firefox, mm-hmm. which you know, we'll put it in full screen and make it so it can't right click. Or and I think it'll remap the control and the alt keys mm-hmm. inside Firefox so someone couldn't change your virtual terminal or anything like that. That might be all you're doing if it's just an internet kiosk.
Cool. Well, thanks.
Hey.
No problem.
As far as future topics, there's been a couple things that I've kind of been interested in. Some of my other Linux friends, like me, just have all these extra motherboards laying around their house that don't know what to do with them. I think it would be interesting if... Has anybody ever played with Linux BIOS? Open BIOS stuff?
No, I haven't. Been kind of interested, though.
There is a super short list a really short list of supported motherboards. So I was almost wondering if maybe there would be a way that we could ask everybody, you know, check your motherboards. If you have this model, let us play with Linux BIOS. It's really easy to back up your BIOS and restore it, so I wouldn't be dangerous at all. We could easily, you know, just back up the original BIOS and play with Linux BIOS. I don't know, I just thought it... Some websites are claiming to get to a full X session in 2 seconds.
Yeah. I've heard they can run... They can actually... If someone else can actually run programs out of the BIOS.
Oh, yeah, and that's a whole other really neat project, SplashBib, where they have a whole X server and Firefox built into the BIOS.
Yeah,
it's going to be built on...
And people keep trying to get them to put it in this.
That's right, I heard that.
Because the BIOS storage is big enough that you can stick in Firefox in there.
Yeah.
You could be running this straight out of the BIOS.
But they say half the boot up time in most BIOSes is probing the hardware, which Linux does a pretty good job of doing itself, is loading support for DOS.
Really?
Yeah.
Your BIOS does a lot of DOS-specific stuff.
Huh. That's kind of a shame.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.